and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. I'm Dr. Dawn Motika, your host for an hour of medical debate, dialogue, discussion, healthcare, and science in the news, and answers to your questions via email or phone. In a few minutes, I'll be giving out the numbers, but before I do that, I need to remind you that the opinions expressed on this program represent those of the speakers, and not necessarily those of this station, its staff, or its contributors. Furthermore, the purpose of this program is education and entertainment. It's not intended as a substitute for a professional consultation. So I wanted to start off with some emails. First of all, Sam from Missouri. I'm a longtime listener to your show. I've personally benefited. I have two brief stories I'd like to share. Last year, my joint pain had gotten so bad I was having to avoid stairs. I hadn't made the connection that had started after doubling my statin dose, but when you mentioned the CoQ10 and statin connection, I tried the CoQ10, and my knees were fine within a couple weeks. I'd assumed it was old age. I'm 52, but apparently the statins were doing that to me. Wow. More recently, you explained grapefruit juice and statins. I rushed in and asked my doctor about reducing my statin dosage and drinking grapefruit juice, and he agreed. I just received my follow-up results. My cholesterol is fine on the reduced dosage, half the original. So not only do I get by on a lower statin dosage, I get to drink grapefruit juice again. Thanks for sharing your knowledge. And I read that one not to pat myself on the back so much as to reprise a couple of very useful little tidbits. If you use grapefruit juice, you can reduce your statin dose easily by 50% and sometimes more in other people. And of course, what pharma says is, oh, well, don't drink grapefruit juice. Well, how about we exploit that and use less of the drug? The other thing about the CoQ10, always, 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 you should leave things the way you found them. Yeah, my mom probably tried to start teaching me that at about the age of 3. Sometimes it actually, in some circumstances, took. In this one in particular, so when I find a patient has, let's say, a high cholesterol, and I know that their CoQ10 level in their blood is going to be, let's say, between X and 2X, well, I'm going to leave it at X to 2X and put some back in, because once I give the statin, I am impairing the body's ability to make this important antioxidant. Why not put things back the way you found them? Seems to make sense to me. This one from Greg in Watsonville. What would you recommend for someone with no insurance, can't get it because I have a pre-existing condition, who just went to the ER with some classic heart attack symptoms, but the test came back negative for that? The EKG showed my heart to be, in the doctor's words, quote, throwing a lot of PVCs, unquote. They did want to keep me in for testing, but I knew that an overnight stay would be tens of thousands of dollars, and opening the bill would probably give me the real deal, meaning a heart attack. Are there any office visit tests that would nail down what's going on? In the words of the nurse, the tests keep telling us what it's not, but we really don't know what it is. Well, actually, Greg, we have some clues there. The fact that you had PVCs is an indication of cardiac irritability. Now, you don't describe your symptoms, but you did say classic heart attack symptoms, so I'm assuming that there was some left-sided chest pressure or chest pain. And I want to start out with talking about PVCs and then move into your context, which I think is a little bit more ominous. Premature ventricular contractions are common. If you took the average person and put them on a monitor, you would hear or see on your monitor, depending on whether it was auditory or visual output, one PVC per couple of hours, call it 5 to 10 a day, in a normal individual. And a premature ventricular contraction is exactly that. The ventricle contracts early, PVC. And it does that because all of the cells in the heart, every single one of them, actually, is capable of becoming a pacemaker cell. The heart has so much fail-safe redundancy, it's unbelievable. And depending on what part of the heart you're in, these cells have a different threshold for firing. So, for example, up in the right atrium, which is where your pacemaker is, the pacemaker cells have a threshold for firing and recharging their little battery capacitor, which is how they fire. You know, you recharge the capacitor, it gets to a certain level, it fires, recharge, fire. That's how the neurons are working in the pacemaker cells, and their recharge rate is faster. So in general, they fire first, and that's what creates your 60 to 100 beats per minute, which we consider to be the physiologic normal. If you step on the gas, In other words, squirt adrenaline onto the right heart, what you get is an increase in that firing rate. And a lot of adrenaline, let's say from chronic stress or from too much caffeine, which has an adrenaline-like effect on the heart, or perhaps too much alcohol, which is mildly toxic and stimulates this problem, or too many decongestants or energy drinks, you get the idea. Stimulants. And of course, let's not leave out cocaine and crank. So stimulants make the heart beat faster and they make all of these cells more irritable and increase the risk of PVCs. So that's a most common reason that people come in with lots of PVCs. I want to mention one other source of irritability, and I'm a little worried this is your source. And that source of irritability is cardiac ischemia. In other words, poor blood flow to a tiny little area somewhere in your ventricle. And that poor blood flow leads to a situation where the cells aren't getting the appropriate nutrition and they become irritable. And when nerve cells become irritable, they fire randomly, and hence premature ventricular contractions. Now, I'm going to, you know, give a shout out to healthcare reform and say pre-existing condition goes away. And Greg, if you've been refused and you can prove it because you've got a letter and it's been more than 6 months, then you already can qualify for health insurance through the high-risk pools in the state of California. So if you go to the website, askdrdon.com, go to the resources page, there's a link to, well, basically how to get insurance. All you need is to have been going bare for 6 months and be able to prove you've been rejected. So if you don't know about that, it's because it's not being advertised, because even though the state legislature passed it and it's there, they really don't want everybody who's eligible knowing about it, I think, because the state budget won't handle it. In any event, you probably qualify. Go get yourself some health insurance and then get yourself a stress echocardiogram. And that is a test where you will exercise and you'll be hooked up to an EKG. Maybe they'll be able to localize the area that's not getting enough blood flow. You may just save yourself from a heart attack, man. The fact that you weren't having an actual heart attack at the time, well, what that means is you didn't kill any heart cells, but you might have been starving some, and that might have been triggering your PVCs. And I'm really worried for you. So don't stop walking out of the ER. You really need to chase this. My producer says he thinks that the plan is fully federally funded. But in any event, it hasn't been well publicized at all, and the general public doesn't know about it. Let's go to our next email, this from D in Monterey. In November 2009, I was rushed to the ER because of the numbness feeling in my right hand. I had X-ray, MRI, and CT, but the result was negative. I'm 75 years old, and currently I'm taking Benicar for controlling hypertension. The only sandpaper feeling on my right index finger and thumb are still existing. At first, my doctor told me the sensation would disappear after 6 months. He also prescribed gabapentin in April of this year, but it doesn't help. My question is whether acupuncture will unfreeze these nerve endings in my finger and thumb. Thank you very much and appreciate your response. Well, first of all, I think that I want to emphasize you may have had a small stroke that doesn't show up even on an MRI because there's a limit to resolution. And if you have altered sensation in just the finger and thumb, it's a very, very small area of brain. It's possible that you could have had a small stroke that affected your sensation. But there's also a lot of possibility that there could be pressure on the nerve as it comes out of the spinal cord, passes through muscles, makes its way down through tight spots in your wrist and tight spots at your elbow. But particularly, I would think about maybe a carpal tunnel syndrome. You didn't clarify the location of that well enough for me to say, but a pinched nerve somewhere along its path is certainly a possibility. When I see this presentation in my acupuncture office, because I don't know if it's a local issue or a central nervous system issue, I will typically do both channel acupuncture running along the acupuncture meridian that corresponds to the location of your altered sensation, and I'll do something called scalp acupuncture and maybe also ear acupuncture, which are mainly directed at the central nervous system. Whether it's successful or not varies from patient to patient, but I have seen it work in my own personal practice and it is definitely worth a try. And let's go to one more email, this one from Mary in Texas. Thank you so much for taking time to read and answer the questions on my mom's carotid blockage. My husband and I intuitively resisted the idea of surgery, but that's not good enough to make a responsible decision. You hear it all the time, but must repeat it. You use your wonderful talents to educate and help people. I know you could get more relaxation time in, but instead you perform public service. Thank you very much. I'm not going to read her last name. In any event, thank you for the shout out, Mary. It kind of keeps me going. So let's talk about some of the interesting stories in the news. And there were two environmental pollution stories this week that I wanted to get to. The first one was California has the pregnant women have the highest levels of a toxic flame retardant in their bloodstream, the highest levels ever recorded worldwide. We're number one. The researchers at UC San Francisco reported last Wednesday they had 25 second trimester pregnant women from Northern and Central California, and they showed very high levels of PBDE, which is polybrominated diphenyl ethers. And these are structurally similar to polychlorinated biphenyls, the PCBs products that were used in, I believe, mostly insulators, got into the water table, and now are also part of our body fat in industrial California. This is an issue. These PCBs and PBDEs are an issue because to the hormone receptor, they look like estrogen. They have a moderate estrogenic effect, not as strong as the actual hormone, but if you have a high enough level and a tissue sensitive enough to it, so for example, a fetus, which relies on very subtle signaling to differentiate, there is the potential for real harm at the levels that are being found. A source of this now, that it's actually been taken out of the environment in terms of new products, but because it's a flame retardant, it was used in a lot of furniture, a lot of foam, and particularly deteriorating foam rubber in couches, in secondhand mattresses and furniture. Those things have lost their structural integrity, and the flame retardant particles, these PCBEs, are coming off as dust. When you sit down on the couch and you get a little poof of dust coming out from the cushions, it contains high levels of these flame retardants. So naturally, people who would buy and use secondhand furniture are the poorer people, and they are the ones who indeed are showing up with the highest levels of this compound. I think it's really important for us to emphasize that pregnant women are at risk in the environmental levels that we've got. Switching to vinyl-covered furniture. If you do buy a secondhand couch, I would get a secondhand leather or vinyl couch where you're not going to get as much of this foam material deteriorating and coming into your environment. And as I said, two stories. A related story, the EPA has said that it will consider testing for bisphenol A. Over 1 million pounds of this chemical are released into the environment every year. And this is used as a food can lining. It's used in epoxy paints. It's used in cash register receipts. So think about this, those thermal paper receipts. You go to the fast food place, which I don't recommend, but you go anywhere and buy some food. You washed your hands because you're a good citizen. Then you went and bought the food, paid for it, and held the receipt in your right hand before you tossed it or while you were signing it. Well, now you've got some BPA on your fingers and you're about to eat that healthy, whatever it is, finger food, because of course you wouldn't be eating French fries if you're a listener to this program. Anyway, whatever you're eating, your fingers have BPA on them. Just like, oh my God, you can't escape this stuff. So the EPA is looking for comments. They're trying to decide whether they should test for this. And of course, they're also thinking about maybe further examining the potential human health effects. A little late, but better late than never. Let's go to Susan in Carmel. Hello, Susan. Welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I listen to your program frequently, and I find it so helpful. I want to speak to you about osteoporosis. I have been a patient who's been diagnosed with osteopenia many years ago. I had been taking Fosamax. Recently, I had a fall and broke my ankle and spent 2 months without any exercise. Normally, I'm a walker. I practice yoga, and I try to keep myself strong. After this period of actually it was more like 3 months with very little movement, I had a regular bone scan and was diagnosed now with osteoporosis. Physician recommended that I make an appointment to receive a drug called Reclass. I'm sure you know what that is, and an annual medication I'm not exactly sure how it works. I just want to say a couple more things about that. I realized when I was diagnosed that I hadn't taken enough calcium for many, many years. I never really did the research. I was very insufficient, and receiving the diagnosis, of course, made me go out and do a research and correct that. So I am a person who is a kidney donor. So I understand from research on Reclass that it can be damaging to the donor, the patient. I also want to say that I'm 71 years old. So these are my concerns.
Okay, well, let's start with, can you tell me your T-score?
I wasn't given my T-score, actually.
Okay, well, I think it's really important to first look at what your T-score is.
Mm-hmm. And is that a score that measures the extent of bone loss?
Yes, T-scores are a relative measure. So if we take the 35-year-old woman, she's 30 to 35, we sort of consider that to be the age at which women reach their maximum bone density statistically. Mm-hmm. A really good benchmark for healthy bone. So we take that and we effectively say, what ratio have you got? So if you have, for example, 35-year-old woman is the standard, that's the 0 point. So if you have a T-score of -1, that means you're 1 standard deviation below the healthy normal range. If you have a -2.5, then we call it osteoporosis. Anything below -1 is osteopenia. At the osteoporosis mark, -2.5, you have an increased risk of fracture. So let's say that your fracture risk, I'm going to arbitrarily say, is 4 times greater than the 35-year-old T-score equals 0 person. So that's
a more severe fracture?
No, I mean any fracture.
The chance.
Okay. Any fracture. Your chance of slip, fall down, sit down hard, break your hip. That's essentially the fractures we're talking about.
Yeah.
Those are the ones we worry about. And that's not the entire denominator of fractures. But let's just,
correct,
for the sake of understanding, say the whole point of treatment is to try to reduce your risk of that big fracture.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. The key here is what's, you know, your risk. In the case of your fall, was this a fall from a height? Did you fall down some stairs? Did you step off a curb and break your ankle? Was there provocation for the fracture?
The event was that I slipped on wet wood and my feet went out from under me.
Okay.
So it was a slip.
All right. So you fell down hard and you broke your ankle, not your hip.
No, my ankle.
Yeah. And you landed on your butt?
Yes.
Okay. All right. So the fracture of the ankle was kind of a shear and a twist type fracture.
Exactly.
And the fact is you sat down hard and you didn't break your hip, which is the one
that's
we would...
That's right.
Yes, that's good. Second question I have is, what's the family history of fracture?
Relatively little family history. I can't think of any fractures
good.
In the
okay.
family.
And no women who got real hunched over and, you know, had like an L-shaped spine?
No, I've got that. No.
Okay. All right. I have a couple of things that I want to say about T-scores. First of all, it's just a risk measurement, and it doesn't measure everything because we're measuring density. We're not measuring structural integrity. And it turns out that you can increase bone density and not necessarily change fracture rates. And you can also have a very low bone density and no fractures. And there's whole ethnic groups that have lower bone densities but lower fracture incidence. And so you can't really apply the T-score to those groups.
Mm-hmm. And that group might belong to that. I believe that Ashkenazi Jews are part of that group.
Yes.
Well, I am a part of that group.
Right. So there's lots of variables here, and unfortunately, all of our statistics are based on large groups, and you can't individualize them. Now, the Reclass that you're being suggested to take is a bisphosphonate. So it's essentially the same as Fosamax or Actonel.
I see.
It acts on the osteoclasts and effectively doesn't act on the osteoclast. It acts on the bone itself, and it makes it indigestible to the osteoclasts, which then are not able to remodel the bone. Now, the problem with osteoporosis is you break down bone faster than you build it up. And one of the things that makes you build bone is walking around. So during the period of time that you were off your feet, you lost a lot of bone.
Exactly.
Now that you're back on your feet, you need to be taking calcium, 1,500 milligrams a day. Take it in three divided doses so that you absorb most of it. Don't take it all at once. You need to be on vitamin D, and you should get a blood level and make sure your vitamin D is at least 35 to 40. And take whatever level of supplementation, 5,000 units a day, whatever level of supplementation it takes to get that blood level up where it needs to be.
Mm-hmm.
Any history of kidney stones?
No.
All right, so that's about the only reason not to do what I just suggested.
And how many milligrams did you say a day? Vitamin D, or it depends on the blood level?
Roughly 5,000 units to get the blood level up where it needs to be, and then whatever it needs to maintain it. So you keep that blood level above 35. That means the calcium that you put in your mouth is going to absorb into your bloodstream. That's what that's the action of vitamin D here. And once it's in your bloodstream, if you are walking and doing some jump ropes, 40 jumping jacks a day, going up and down stairs, those sorts of bouncy kind of jarring movements stimulate the bone. And you can put some bone back down. All right. I would focus on building up the bone and then maybe repeat the bone scan before doing reclast. I am not a big fan of the bisphosphonates. The best case scenario here, and I want to emphasize this, and I just looked these statistics up this morning, so obviously it was meant for you to call, but the best case scenario here is that the reclast will take your fracture risk. If you have true osteoporosis and you are at risk, you have a 2% fracture risk per year. Two out of, you know, 1 in 50. It will take it to 1%. It cuts it in half. But since your absolute risk is pretty low, cutting it in half is not such a big deal. So if you've gone from a 2% risk to a 1% risk by doing this IV stuff. I don't like the IV. It's a big, huge dose. And I just, there's something about the concept of just blasting the bones with this compound. And, you know, we know that it can have an effect in the mouth and the jaw. If people have a bad infection at the root of a tooth, and you can have those silently, and you blast with a bisphosphonate, you interfere with the body's ability to fight that infection. And the infection will just very happily eat away at the bone for the whole year, that the system can't remodel that bone.
Yes, so, that's another area at my age that I consider my teeth a very important asset.
Well, your jaw is an important asset.
Yes.
And these chronic infections, I want to emphasize, they're rare, and as are the atypical femur fractures, which we're also starting to see, where people, instead of the bone breaking at the hip, which is what osteoporosis does, it breaks in the middle of the shaft, which is just weird, and you don't see that, except in people who've been on long-term bisphosphonates. We're messing around here. Is the benefit worth it? I would certainly be very cagey about doing IV bisphosphonate in you, even without knowing your T-score. Now, if your T-score is -4 or -5, you might want to look at a short-term course of Forteo, F-O-R-T-E-O.
And F-E-R.
F-O-R.
F-O-R.
T-E-O. Now, this is an injection, which is, I don't know, politically undesirable. Commercially, people are less likely to want to do injections. But I actually like this drug for osteoporosis, and you had a fracture after using a bisphosphonate, so you could probably qualify on your insurance for this. And what this drug does is it actually builds new bone. Now, it's a little indiscriminate, and you might get calcification in other tissues, and that's why it's a second-line drug rather than a first-line drug, which is appropriate. But I like the idea of, hey, let's build some new bone. And let's not forget good old-fashioned estrogen. There's drugs like Evista, which is an estrogen-like drug, tends to have a lower lifetime risk of breast cancer when you take this drug, and helps stabilize the bones without using a bisphosphonate. So, you know, that'd
be the name of that product again?
That's E-V-I-S-T-A.
Thank you.
All right. So I hope I've opened up the options for you a little bit there.
Yes, you did, and you reinforced my suspicion of this kind of approach. to dealing with this. I'd much rather take the longer term and work on myself than undergo that.
And just tell your doctor, you know, I'd like to make a formal refusal to do this therapy, and I am accepting the risks of not following your medical advice. I appreciate it. I respect you. I'm taking another path, and you're off the hook medical legally. Just please put an informed refusal in the chart, because what happens to us as doctors is, think of a school of fish, all right? You got a school of fish, the sharks are on the outside, and they're picking off the fish that are stragglers, right? The ones that are on the outside edges of the school of fish. Where's your safest place to be? In the middle of the school of fish, and the school of fish is called the standard of care. So if a drug rep can scare you into thinking that the standard of care is to use Reclast in a woman who's had a fracture after bisphosphonate use, which, by the way, makes no sense at all. Give her more bisphosphonate after it's failed. But if they can convince you that that's the middle of the school of fish, then that's the kind of advice you give. And it's an insidious process, this kind of fear-based medicine that we've gotten looped into. And we'll never, ever, ever get the cost of healthcare down until doctors stop practicing defensive medicine, which means we need to get the lawyers out of the mix. I'm sorry, tort lawyers. I know that sometimes harm is done by evil corporations, but we've got a systemic issue here that is driving the way we do medicine in an insane way. We just have to take the lawyers out of it and do what we did maybe with the vaccines, you know, have a no-fault thing. But we've got to get out of this loop. Sorry for the soapbox.
Oh, no, no. I completely appreciate it, and it's important to hear that over and over again so we can make changes.
All right. Well, you have a good day now.
Thank you very much.
Bye-bye. And let's go now to Jessica in Hollister. Hello, Jessica. Welcome to the show.
Hello. Hello. I had a question about tea and iron absorption. I've been hearing that drinking tea while eating foods that have iron, you'd be reducing your ability to absorb it, and I do have borderline anemia, and so, and I drink tea all day long, so one, I'm interested in knowing if that is true, and secondly, I drink a tea called yerba mate, and also mate, maybe you've heard it, and just wondering if that falls under the same lines as just general tea. And then the third part is, if it is a real issue, if there's a certain length of time that you should be waiting before eating your meal or after, or before or after.
Got it. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. How do you manage to make this work? Okay, well, first of all, let's get serum iron levels and serum transferrin levels and make sure that your iron storage is really low, because there's other reasons people can have borderline anemia. So I would get a serum iron and one of the two storage proteins, either ferritin or transferrin. And if those are low, then yes, you're having a problem with iron absorption. The basis for this is the tannic acid that's in all forms of tea. Green tea and black tea both have some tannic acid that's higher in the black teas, but it's still present in the green.
Mm-hmm.
So mate, I'm not sure if there is any tannic acid in yerba buena. I don't know that. But you know what? If you were to Google that, just put into a browser tannic acid and mate, I'm sure that something in the first 20 sites that came up would actually have a declarative statement that it either does or does not have it. So find that out, and you might want to switch. In terms of timing, the main thing is that these not be present in the stomach at the same time. That's where the binding takes place. The concept is that the iron gets bound to the tannic acid, and then it doesn't get absorbed. So if you figure that gastric emptying is 45 minutes to an hour, spacing it by about an hour would probably do the trick.
Okay.
And you want to make sure that your iron is low before you start taking iron supplements, because iron supplements are pro-inflammatory, and older people don't need any more inflammation than they've got.
Mm-hmm. I'm trying to work through it with food and not through supplements, so I want to be sure that when I'm eating it, I'm actually getting the benefit of it.
Exactly. That's wise. All right. Well, good luck to you.
Okay, and would you mind repeating what I needed to check? I didn't.
T-A-N-N-I-C, acid. Okay? Have a good day.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye. And let's go to Margaret in Santa Cruz. Hello, Margaret. Welcome to the program.
Yes. Thank you, Dr. Don. Thank you so much for being there. I really find your program wonderful and not only entertaining, but informative. I wonder if you could possibly speak about something that my OBGYN surprised me with just recently. That was that he said that it's now considered that cervical cancer is in clusters of cervical cancer in families, and that's true for my own family. It's thought that cervical cancer is caused or promoted by certain deficiencies in the immune system. Can you speak to that?
Well, in general, I think whenever you see a familial cancer cluster,
yes,
you always postulate one of two issues in that family. It's either something wrong with the ability to prevent a cancer, which mm-hmm. I'll come back to, or something wrong with the surveillance and early destruction of cancers.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two mechanisms. There's the immune system, which is supposed to recognize when a cell becomes transformed and attack the cancer cells while they're small,
mm-hmm.
before they develop a blood supply and before they develop the ability to migrate through the system.
Mm-hmm.
And when we go looking for cancers in healthy people, we find them. Somebody gets run over by a car. They get sent to a morgue in Chicago. And mm-hmm. so all the women 45 through, let's say 35 through 55, who get killed in a car accident, who have no known disease, somebody says, well, let's look for breast cancer and see how many undiagnosed breast cancers there are walking around in the streets of Chicago. And lo and behold, they find women, like a third of the women have breast cancer, small little breast cancers, maybe more than one. Yet we don't have a third of the women walking around Chicago showing up with breast cancer later on. So they're fighting off and killing their own breast cancers all the time.
Mm-hmm.
So if that's broken, then you'll see more breast cancer or more cervical cancer or maybe even more cancer across the board in the family line.
Mm-hmm.
Then you can also have specific things that don't get fought, like this particular type of cancer is the only one that the immune system can't address. And then on the front end, you can have proofreading errors. So our cells, when they divide, make mistakes in the DNA. And there are little proofreaders that run along the DNA before that cell's allowed to finish dividing and correct it. If your proofreading isn't perfect, you get a mutation. And eventually, if you accumulate enough mutations, you get a cancer. So proofreading errors will tend to show up as familial cancer clusters. And often it'll be different cancers in that circumstance, but different common cancers. And there's all sorts of other things that happen because people can be born. Cancer is a series of mutations. If you're carrying in your germ cells, say, three of the five necessary mutations, then you're born cancer-free. But just statistically, over your lifetime, you're going to run into something that will mutate your cells, the next two mutations that are necessary for the cancer to erupt, and off we go. The other things are, this is very important, folic acid metabolism issues, because folic acid is really critical for the prevention of cervical cancers. So if I see a familial cluster of cervical cancers, I'm going to go look for folic acid mutations like the MTHFR mutation. And if the person has that, supplement them with a different kind of folic acid, kind of a downstream sort of folic acid that gets past that place where they have a mutation in their physiology. You get the feeling there's a Pandora's box of possibility here whenever you have a cancer
yes.
cluster?
Yes.
So don't smoke.
Oh, no, don't.
And extra folic acid, get the MTHFR mutation.
Mm-hmm.
When you have a pap smear, you should be checked for the HPV. So I would find out if you have persistent...
Oh, yes. I'm already past that. I've had a carcinoma in situ in the cervix, and I've had a total hyst.
Okay. So you're thinking about
because of
family.
The family background. Right.
Right.
And two of my daughters have already had carcinoma in situ of the cervix, and they've been lasered. So I'm thinking about future generations.
Everybody should get the vaccine, the cervical...
Yes.
The cervical cancer vaccines. There's two. There's Gardasil and Cervarix. I'd probably go with Cervarix for that family because it has a couple more antigens in it.
Oh.
So it has maybe a little bit better coverage on the cancer, but it doesn't prevent the venereal warts. I'd just take my venereal warts and risk, but I'd go with the one that hits more of the cancer-causing epitopes.
All right.
All right. Good luck.
Thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Let's go to Andrea. Hello, Andrea. Welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Very well. How are you doing?
Good. I love your program. I have a quick question about, I started taking everyday calcium supplements from Rainbow Light. It's a pretty high dosage. It's 1,200 milligrams of calcium and 1,200 of magnesium and 1,000 IUs of vitamin D.
And that's in how many pills?
It's in four.
Okay.
And I know that you're supposed to spread it out over the day, but I just don't. And then it also has enzymes in it, which, you know, sometimes I think that they do something and sometimes they don't. But it's a protease and amylase and lipase and cellulase. So my question is, it seems like it's really changing my digestion. Like, I've always had a harder time digesting in general.
Mm-hmm.
I'm really, like, top of my health, but I am breastfeeding and I have two children. And
when you say a hard time digesting, how does that manifest?
I tend towards constipation.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, it's just how I manifest.
Right. So it's low throughput, we'll call it.
Yeah, I would say that it probably has something to do with the peristaltic action.
Yeah. Go ahead. And your question is, why is it improved?
It's more like, I mean, because all of a sudden when I have to go, like, I have to go. And
I have an answer for you.
Yeah.
Okay. First of all, part of it's because you're taking it all at once. And one of the best ways to give someone diarrhea is to give them too much magnesium.
Oh.
More magnesium than your intestine can absorb.
Yeah.
It will sit, will sit there, and it won't sit there, actually. It'll move right on through. It creates what's called an osmotic situation where you pull fluid into the colon, and that kind of moves things through, and often they won't be fully formed because they rushed right through. So you're not absorbing the magnesium. It's stimulating your bowel. You want to break up the dosing. I'm fine with 1,200 milligrams of magnesium and calcium at an equal ratio. I think eventually that will be the standard in terms of supplements. So that's good.
Okay.
I'm not worried about the vitamin D. 1,000 is not a high dose. And you can't physiologically absorb more than 500 milligrams of calcium at a time. It just won't get in.
Okay.
So breaking up the pills, you got to do, I would say, two, ideally three, and it's a pain in the rear to figure out how to do it. Maybe keeping some in the car. If you drive and you've got the pills right there, it's like, okay, time to take a pill. When you drive to your lunch, I don't know what your lifestyle is like, but you need to pin it to some behavior that you're doing in the middle of the day.
Okay.
And another behavior at night could be the brushing of the teeth, you know, at bedtime.
Right.
So then there's another pill. So you could maybe get it into three and you'll get a lot more benefit.
Okay.
Okay.
All right. Thanks so much.
You're welcome. Have a great day.
Cheers. You too. Bye.
Bye. Before we go to our next caller, I want to give you a health tip recently published, and I'm going to tweet this with the actual reference. So watch for that in the next day or two. And by the way, you can subscribe to my Twitter feed or my Facebook feed at AskDrDawn.com. Just click on the little appropriate little link. This was published in The Lancet last December, and these researchers did a 20-year study on aspirin use. And these were people taking low-dose aspirin, 81 milligrams, actually 75 in England, but, you know, whatever, low-dose aspirin for heart disease prevention. What the researchers also discovered was that the risk of death from cancer dropped by 20%. And this was a durable effect. It didn't start until 5 years of aspirin use. But if you were a 20-year user, the reduction in cancer risk was actually 34%. So on all of the people studied, they got a 20%. But on the long-term aspirin users, the magnitude was even higher at 34%. And this wasn't just colon cancer. That's old news. We've known about the colon cancer aspirin connection for a very long time. This one also showed decreased death from cancer of pancreas, brain, stomach, prostate, and lung cancer and esophageal cancer. Wow, that's pretty important. And some of these were really big. The risk of cancer of the esophagus was 60% lower. Aspirin is very good for the heart. So taking an aspirin a day, if you're diabetic, you should be taking an aspirin a day no matter what your age. If you are walking around on the planet for more than 50 years, I'm going with an aspirin a day keeps the doctor away. And we're talking about a low-dose aspirin. And it is going to increase your risk of gastrointestinal bleeding, but the magnitude of that risk is very low compared to the magnitude of the benefit. So let's all go out and get ourselves some low-dose aspirin. 81 milligrams is what low-dose means. And let's go to Kenya in Santa Cruz. Hello and welcome to the program.
Hi.
Hi.
I am calling because I have numbing in my little finger. And when I get up in the morning, I have like severe numbing in my feet. I can hardly walk on them. You know, once I get moving and the circulation gets going, it's okay. This is when I don't take high blood pressure medication. I wasn't consistent with it. And then I started being consistent with my high blood pressure medication. Then it completely goes away. So I'm just wondering what's up with that.
Well, not entirely sure. The numbness in the little finger.
Yeah.
The most common cause of that is just sleeping on your back or on your side in the elbow that is getting mushed. And there's a place where the nerve gets squeezed.
Okay.
At the elbow. And that'll cause numbness on the little finger very consistently.
Uh-huh.
Usually patting the elbow at night takes care of it. So you could try that. As far as the numbness is on the feet is concerned, a couple possibilities present themselves. I'm not clear whether it's from your blood pressure medication that you're getting the benefit or not. But if it were, you've made the connection that when I take my blood pressure medication, I don't get this. So how could that be working is what I'm about to answer. There could be other explanations for the numbness in your feet, and this may be a false correlation. But if it's true, then I would say reactive vasospasm is the cause, and that means that your blood vessels are tightening up at night, maybe because of positioning or maybe for some other physiologic reason. When you start to get atherosclerosis, the blood vessels get a little twitchy and they can close when they should open and vice versa. I don't know if you're in the menopausal range, but...
I just ate about 3 years into it.
So at that age, the estrogen, which is a stabilizer of the blood vessel wall, is gone away and the blood vessel wall is extra twitchy from that as well. And if your blood pressure medication was either a beta blocker or a calcium channel blocker, two classes of drugs which have a direct stabilization effect on the blood vessel wall, then that would kind of pull it all together as a good explanation of why this is true.
Okay.
So if there's a correlation, I think it's a drug effect on the blood vessel wall rather than this is a mini stroke that I'm having. And when I take the blood pressure medications and my blood pressure is lower, I'm not having these mini strokes every day. I don't think that it's a central nervous system effect that you're experiencing.
You think it's sort of a mini stroke?
No, I don't think
that. Oh, okay.
My thinking is that you may have been worried about that. So
yeah,
I'm trying,
because it runs in the family.
Yeah, I'm trying to reassure you that that's not how that behaves.
Okay.
But I think it may be a more local blood vessel effect.
Is there anything to prevent it other than blood pressure medication? Because I take a really low dose. I exercise a lot. But it seems like after a few days it goes up, you know, when I stop taking it, and then I have trouble with my feet, and, you know, it just doesn't seem like things are right.
Okay, so let's keep the blood pressure under control.
Okay.
So a couple things that you can do there. There's a link on my website, askdrdon.com. If you go to the resources page, it'll take you to the DASH diet, which is a diet that lowers blood pressure.
Okay.
It involves moderately high doses of calcium in the form of dairy and lots of fruits and vegetables.
Okay.
Go get some potassium. Go get some salt substitute. Not because salt is bad, but because potassium is good.
Okay.
If you aren't diabetic, eat a banana every day. And do low-salt V8, which low-sodium V8 has lots of potassium in it. If you drink one of those a day, that helps raise your potassium. You want to get your potassium and your magnesium high, so take some extra magnesium, maybe 300 to 400 milligrams three times a day, whatever your bowel will handle, referencing the previous caller who was having some, let's say, rapid throughput from too much magnesium all at once. You need to guard against that. And what we're trying to do here with all of these interventions is relax the blood vessels, open them up, lower your blood pressure. So exercising by walking half an hour a day, also very good for lowering blood pressure. If you do all of those things and stay on your blood pressure medicine while you're ramping up on all of this stuff.
Okay.
Okay. Then when you feel that you've got the magnesium on board at the maximum dose, you're getting all this extra potassium, you're eating the seven fruits and vegetables a day, then drop the blood pressure medicine and monitor your blood pressure. This is very important. Monitor your blood pressure while you're doing this, because a lot of people don't actually have to be on drugs. Another thing that's a natural way to help blood pressure is an amino acid called L-arginine.
L-arginine?
Arginine, yeah, A-R-G. And L-arg, we're going to, for short, lowers blood pressure if you take 3,000 or 4,000 milligrams a day. And in a lot of people, that is beneficial. This is a massive dose of this amino acid. It's as much as you might get in eating a couple of servings of protein a day, beefsteak or something like that. When I say massive, I'm being facetious. Mm-hmm. It's not that much. And it's 4 grams of a particular amino acid. The only issue with using L-arginine is it competes with L-lysine. So I have had people who have herpes give themselves a herpes attack by taking a lot of L-arginine.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess if you have that problem, take the L-arginine and balance it with some extra lysine at the opposite end of the day so that you absorb both sets of amino acids. And that's lore. The scientific basis for that is purely on the basis of biochemistry. There's no controlled studies in humans about the lysine-arginine herpes thing. It's just a clinical observation. So throwing it out there, I like to try to tell people how good is the evidence for what I say when I remember to do so.
Okay. All right, now the salt substitute, what would that be?
Morton's Salt makes a salt substitute that has potassium iodide.
Okay.
And it tastes a little bitter, so what you want to do is mix that maybe 2/3, 1/3 with regular salt and use that for your cooking and salting of food.
Okay. Thank you so much.
Good luck.
Bye-bye.
Let's talk to Rich in Soquel. Hello, Rich, and welcome to the program.
Hi. I'm 67 years old, and I've taken an 81 milligram aspirin a day for years and years. And I've noticed when I'm working in the yard, if I bump into a branch or something, I can very easily tear the skin of my arm, and I get these large things that look like under the skin bleeding.
Yep, that's what you're getting.
And so I wondered, does that mean I'm taking an overdose of aspirin? I mean, could I just take it once every other day, or is it just to be expected?
If it's your forearms, then you ignore it. If it's your thighs or your shins that are doing that, where, you know, trivial injury causes subcutaneous bleeding, then yeah, you're overreacting to your aspirin. And by the way, every other day aspirin in a large population group does not have the benefits of daily aspirin.
Okay.
So going every other day in, you know, a certain population subset, maybe it would be fine. But across the board, that isn't a good idea. Now back to you. That area on the forearms starts getting way too much sun when we're children out there playing in the sandbox and continues to get way too much sun for our entire lives. So most of us, by the time we're 50, that forearm area is the oldest skin on our body.
Yes.
Maybe the back of the neck if you're a male farmer and haven't worn a cowboy hat, but that forearm skin gets really damaged. And most of what's happening in your case is due to that damage.
Uh-huh.
The scaffolding support structure, which is like a fishnet stocking, that supports all of the little capillaries is all full of runs and tears, and it's no longer doing a very good job supporting the blood vessels. So trauma rips the blood vessels, and yes, because you have aspirin on board, you might bleed a little more and have a somewhat larger tear, but you're not having those tears because of the aspirin.
Okay.
So what you want to do, if you know you've hit yourself, by the way, is put your hand on the area and push down hard for about 2 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Okay, if you do that, then you give the blood a chance to clot, and you'll significantly reduce the size of the big patch of purple that you have to live with for the next, you know, 2-3 weeks before it goes away.
Oh, great. I'll try that for sure.
Ice works even better, but if you're out in the yard and you just, you know, just put your hand on it, push down, and, you know, recite the Gettysburg Address, and you'll be good.
Okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay, bye-bye. Let's see. We had an off-air question. Does drinking ice-cold fluid with a meal inhibit digestion and contribute to constipation? Well, it might inhibit digestion. Certainly the Chinese medicine lore would say absolutely don't use ice-cold fluid with meals. Certainly you're cooling, you're going to have to warm that fluid up to body temperature before any of the enzymatic processes work decently. So you are losing a little ATP. In terms of contributing to constipation, I'm not aware of any correlation there. We've got just a minute. We're going to try to get to Rebecca in Capitola. Rebecca, time is short. What can I do for you?
Hi, Dr. Don. Thanks for taking my call. I had a test in January, just kind of general test, and I have a high CO2, which I've never heard of, and wonder what can cause that.
Okay, well, what you had, it, I'm assuming, was in a blood test, not a blood gas test. Did they stick the needle in your elbow, or did they stick it in your wrist to get the blood?
Elbow, inside elbow,
yeah,
regular
yeah,
blood.
Yeah, regular place. Okay. So it wasn't your CO2, it was actually your bicarbonate, because that's what we measure, and that's HCO2, which is an important distinction physiologically, but it's related. So effectively, in answering your question, having a high bicarbonate means that your kidneys are usually the culprit here, and they are producing bicarbonate to balance an acid source. So possible acid sources in your blood might be diet. It might be that you have a respiratory acidosis because of a pulmonary function issue. People who have COPD will often have a respiratory acidosis, and so the bicarbonate in their blood goes up to balance that. And the kidneys create bicarbonate to help buffer the blood physiologically to keep the blood pH at about 7.4. If you get much below 7.35 or much above 7.5, your enzyme processes start to go haywire and your physiology breaks down. So it's really important to keep that pH within a normal range. That's what the bicarbonate does. So you're balancing a source. There's all sorts of possibilities, as I've alluded to several just now, and it doesn't necessarily indicate disease. It could just be an indication of an appropriate balancing act that your body is supposed to be doing in the first place.
What's a good place to start with?
Well, I think the first thing to do is get creatinine clearance and make sure your kidneys are healthy. Mm-hmm. And look at your urine pH when you pee and see if your urine pH is very, very low and acid. And you can buy pH paper anywhere.
Okay, I've got
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to have to end it there, but you can call back when you have that information and we'll start breaking it out for you.
All right, thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, we've come to the end of another hour, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as I have. This is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.